Welcome to the World of Women Create podcast series, where we step inside the vibrant, paint-splattered, and high-energy worlds of the artisans and makers from the pages of our magazines, Where Women Create and What Women Create. We'll also meet special guests who are entrepreneurs and experts in their field. From our creative corner to yours, we're inviting you into inspiring conversations with exceptional women. I'm Susan Harold, Editor-in-Chief of Women Create. Join me as we sit down with visionary makers and innovative entrepreneurs to explore the beautiful chaos of the creative life, the trials that test us, the triumphs that fuel us, and the surprising paths that lead to those undeniable creative sparks. Thank you for being a part of our creative world, the world of Women Create. Hello, everyone. So grateful to have you here with us today for an inspiring conversation about creativity and flow. Have you ever looked at a finished piece of work and wondered about the quiet spaces and where it was actually created? Well, today we're going to learn a little bit about that. I want to introduce you to Nicole Shannon. She's an artist, writer, researcher, and founder of Creative Potential. Through her work, writing, and educational programs, she explores creativity, flow state, which is something we're going to get into, and how we create direction when the path ahead is unclear. Drawing from her experiences as an artist, entrepreneur, and mother of a child with a rare genetic condition, Nicole developed Creative Wayfinding, which is a research-informed framework that views creativity not just as artistic expression, but as a fundamental human capacity for navigating uncertainty and change and moving forward with intention. Welcome, Nicole. It's so great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan. I'm really, really excited.
Absolutely. You know, when I kind of got to know you a little bit, you had emailed us and introduced yourself. And honestly, I felt like we could have like 10 different conversations based on what you do and your history and what you know. But let's start off, Nicole, with maybe talking a little bit about flow state. I think that might be a really great place to get started.
Yeah, absolutely. So flow state is that experience that every human has a capability to experience where you have deep engagement and deep focus during an activity. Oftentimes people can recognize when they're in flow state when they lose track of time. So if you've ever been doing a work of art, you're in a creative process, and you look up and you realize that 2 hours have passed when it feels only like 30 minutes, you are likely in flow. Now, flow can actually be something that we experience when we're doing a creative activity, but we can also experience it when we're doing an athletic activity. Scientists, neuroscientists specifically, have done a lot of studies and on flow and identified that the brain can actually flip into flow state when we're doing things like running or surfing, as well as writing and painting. It is something that, from a biological standpoint, they're able to identify what it looks like in the brain, and that it is something repeatable and trainable, which is really amazing.
Trainable. Okay, so I did not realize that, because you do almost think of it as something spontaneous that just happens or doesn't happen. And I think that a lot of artists struggle with that, you know, when you're having that moment of not feeling creative or feeling like you have to get something done because of a deadline, and it's almost like a forced creative moment. How do people access flow consistently, or how do you encourage them to do that?
Yeah, so flow state is something you can activate through basic, what they call flow triggers. And everyone has different triggers that work better for them. And there are validated triggers that you can actually practice and try and to incorporate into your practice. I do want to say that it's important to recognize that flow state as its own entity is not necessarily creative. Like I said, it can be associated with athletic activities or even like gardening. However, when you are in flow state, your creativity is amplified. And it's really hard to put a number to that, but neuroscientists have tried and they've done a number of different case studies, and they've come up with this fascinating 500 times more creative,
wow.
500 times more productive. And so I think that's really interesting. You know, that I've read a number of different research studies that kind of reconfirm this amplified creativity, but there's definitely alignment between productivity and creativity that happens when you're in flow state. And so I always want to encourage people to recognize that we can have a creative idea outside of being in flow state, but when we are in flow state, those creative ideas can happen more rapidly and, of course, with more ease. So one of the things that flow state triggers in our brain is not only this loss of sense of time, but it actually reduces activity in our frontal lobe. They call it the prefrontal cortex, really. And what happens during that time is we have less attention on ourselves. And so that inner critic that we're constantly hearing the voice of, who's saying, that might not be a good choice. Maybe you shouldn't do that. It's naturally quieted down from a biological level. And so that's actually what allows us to have more divergent thoughts, more intriguing and creative endeavors. And so the biggest piece of flow state that I work with in terms of helping people get into a creative state is helping them to activate flow when they're embarking on a creative project, kind of combining those two pieces together.
I did want to explain flow just because I think it's something that we all maybe understand in some capacity, but maybe not to the capacity that you just explained for us, which is really, really helpful that it isn't just about creativity, that it's basically just being in that sense of accepting what's coming to you. But like you said, whether it's athletics or whether it's you're a maker, what inspired you to practice and to study flow state and to develop your creative flow challenge? Like, what was your inspiration there?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in creativity. I've always been interested in how to, utilize it more readily in my life. And also just I've always been fascinated by psychology, and I've always been fascinated by positive psychology. And it was actually a positive psychologist that uncovered flow state. He was trying to, his name is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, and he was really interested in what makes people happy. His childhood or his younger years, he had a direct experience with World War II and a lot of the trauma of World War II. And yet he saw that there were people that lived through that and still had joy and still had purpose. And he was fascinated with what at a core level gives people, this sense of happiness and contentment, that they can even, go through very difficult times. And he interviewed people around the world, and what he uncovered was not what he expected at all. When he asked people what was some of their most joyful moments, some of the most powerful memories of being, happy, they described being in flow state. They described, when they were embarking not only on a creative activity, but when they were surfing, or they lost that sense of time and self and anxiety, and there was a reduction in all the negative thoughts, and they were just in the moment doing what they were doing and doing it with not only their full attention, but also this feeling of ease and this feeling of doing their best at whatever they were doing. And so that was kind of the foundation of the science and the study of flow state. And it was actually Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi who named it flow state, because that was the description that everyone kept giving, as they said it just felt like everything was flowing. And so I uncovered that years ago when I was reading, and then I started to connect the dots in my own life, and I was like, wow, all the things I like to do, rock climbing, rollerblading, painting, ceramics, metalsmithing, these are all things that naturally activate flow state. I was like, man, I must be a flow state junkie. I must really like flow. But it was later, after my son was born, and I had the opportunity to take a coaching program with actually the neuroscientists from the Flow Research Collective, who were doing a really, really intensive program. They claimed it was like master level work in the neuroscience of flow. And it was because it was being taught by neuroscientists who studied flow. And it was just an amazing program. And I actually learned so much, not only about flow state, but also about creativity and the connection of the two. And so I think it's always been a part of my life, I guess, to answer your question. But I kind of formalized my study of it, and also my passion for helping other people connect with it, really in the last like 7 years since COVID is when I took my program. One thing I did want to mention is I always felt a little frustrated and confused, even when I was really young, and people would say, I'm not creative. And I would hear that oftentimes, like when I was, maybe in a setting where, we were looking at art and I was with someone who was going to a gallery with me, and they'd say, "Oh, I love that, but, I can't do it. I'm not creative." And, I found that through the formal study that I did in my coaching program, it really validated the thoughts I always felt that, like, everyone can be creative. It just manifests differently. And so, like, now I have the hard evidence to really prove it. And so I feel like I'm on a mission to help people connect with their creativity, not just in doing, creative projects associated with visual arts or expression, but how do they use it in their everyday lives?
That's amazing. And you're right. It isn't limited to just a creative or a maker. It's something we should all find. We should all be flow state junkies like you. Okay, so tell us a little bit then about how you created the Creative Flow Challenge.
Yeah, so the Creative Flow Challenge is a 15-day challenge, and it has bite-size lessons. I very intentionally made the lessons short. They're all about 5 to 7 minutes. I also combined the lessons with cinematic imagery so that you're not just looking at slideshows, really leaning into the reality that we all know that, we're living in an era where people have short attention spans. And when it comes to digital courses, many people will purchase them and not actually follow through and finish them. And so I really, really wanted people to finish it and get the benefit of it. And so, ironically, though, it's 15 days, 15 short lessons, and it took me about 2 years to put together. And the main reason for this is I had to take all of the research that I had learned through my coaching program and condense it into digestible lessons that also incorporated, which I felt was really important, real life examples of how these techniques and how these activities were applied throughout history. So I don't do a lot of promoting about this piece of the challenge, but I think it's important for your audience to know that within the challenge is not just, the lessons of, okay, how do you get into flow and what are the things you can do to help activate flow state, but it's also examples of scientists, writers, musicians, painters, inventors throughout history who have used these things, who we actually have documented evidence that they've used these techniques to successfully activate flow in their own practices. And I just loved learning all of this and think that it's helpful for us to remember the techniques when we can kind of apply it to stories. And so that's also a piece of what is, available in the challenge to learn. And yeah, it was quite a journey for me to put everything together, but every lesson has the video that incorporates the concept, the application, a story example of the application, and then a way that you can actually do it in an exercise. And one of the other things that I thought was really important is that throughout the 15 days or however long you want to do it, you do have lifetime access to the challenge if you purchase it. The goal is to make something while you're doing this challenge so that you're applying these things to an ongoing project. And one of the things that kept coming up over and over again in the coursework that I took as a coach is that when we do a project or an activity that is not influenced by external goals and external motivation, we are much more likely to follow it through and much more likely to activate flow state. So what I really wanted was that people taking the challenge would embark on a personal creative project, one that is intrinsically motivated, and that would be enough to really get them excited and have them follow it through. And so I make a pretty good effort to clarify in the beginning of the challenge that you need to pick something that you're not intending to post on social media, you're not intending to sell. This
Not a
is something that,
commission. Yeah, it's
yes,
something
not a
driven by your own
commission.
inspiration.
I've had such incredible feedback because of that. People have even realized that there were creative projects that they hadn't even explored in mediums that they hadn't felt that they were experienced enough for, and they allowed themselves to play. And that's really a big piece of giving yourself access to flow.
Absolutely. Now, I know from your personal experiences, you started working with jewelry, right? You were making jewelry and metalsmithing. Now, do you still do that, or have you kind of moved over? I know you do, you're a painter as well, and I know you're working on a sculpting series for our spring issue. But yeah, tell us a little bit about your personal journey through your artistic creativity.
So, as a kid, I was always dabbling in different mediums. I loved just to make things. I also loved to understand how things were put together. So, I was definitely one of those kids that like took toasters apart. And as much as I'd like be painting, like I did oil painting in my backyard with like an easel, you know, like, but then I'd go in the house and like take apart a broken appliance and turn it into like an interesting, I guess, chandelier, you know, like it was definitely a lot of making. But oddly enough, I actually went to school originally for psychology. I just was so interested in how we think and how we live. And I was going to be a therapist. That was my original goal. And I was only about like 3 or 4 months into it. And I was really feeling like I missed making stuff. And I had to face the reality that the more I read about the case studies that were really sad and really difficult in my psychology book, that maybe I wasn't cut out for being a therapist. Like, I was definitely going to be one of those therapists that took everything home. And, you know, that wasn't going to help anyone. And so I made the decision right around Christmas that I would leave, I would transfer out. And so I transferred to a school and applied to be an art major at another university. And yeah, I decided to do metalsmithing because, and this is a strange side note, but my parents, they were antiquers, I guess is the term they used to use. And they would go to different, you know, shows and estate sales on the weekend in upstate New York. And one day they found a tackle box that had sterling silver and pliers and wire and even some turquoise. And they gave it to me when I was only about 9. And that was kind of what started my interest in making jewelry. By the time I got into high school, I took some classes at the community college and learned how to solder, never thinking it would become my main discipline in undergrad. But when I did go to school for art, they did have a metalsmithing department. And so I started taking classes, and that wound up being my focus. I was actually a double major. I did metalsmithing and ceramics. So when I graduated, I just wanted to learn more. I wanted to become really proficient at it. So I left. I was already living about an hour away from New York City. I moved to New York City and I got a job at a custom goldsmithing studio, which is really funny because there's very few of them in the world. And
And there just happened to be.
there's even less now, but I was blessed. I sent out a ridiculous number of emails to every jewelry studio that I had the email contact for, and yeah, I got a job. It was amazing, and it was a high-end goldsmithing studio on Madison Ave. They actually had some really, really old clientele. They worked with like the silver screen movie stars. It was a legacy studio. And yeah, I learned a lot there, but it was when my husband and I got engaged that we decided we wanted to move out of the city. And, you know, there's not a lot of custom goldsmithing studios outside of a major city. So that's when it kind of began the process of me starting my own work and doing my own business.
Well, it's interesting that you kind of made that transition from psychology and then into these various creative disciplines, but in the end, you're combining them back again, right? So you didn't necessarily want to go through the path of becoming a therapist. And I agree with you. I have one of my best friends is a therapist, and I don't know how you don't take that home every single day. She deals a lot with children, and I just think that would be really difficult. But the fact that you were sort of able to use that same education in conjunction with these artistic disciplines, I think is like the perfect marriage for you, really.
Yeah, it's really interesting how life kind of circles back. So if you saw my bookcase, you would see kind of the thread of my interests because I have a lot of books on psychology, on neuroscience, on not just flow state, but the creative process. But then, you know, I have metalsmithing, I have ceramic sculpture, I have painting. And I feel like at this stage in my life, I've figured out a way to integrate them in a way that feels really satisfying. Like this is where I was supposed to be or supposed to come to, but it took all the different paths. So after I left New York, I did open my own gallery, and I showed other artists, painters, sculptors, as well as my jewelry work. And then I started dabbling in doing some, work beyond jewelry. And that was kind of where I started to transition into doing more visual art and less like real functional jewelry work. But the sculpture series that I'm doing now, I'm actually going to incorporate metalwork into it. And that's been really exciting.
Wow.
Doing the ceramics and doing the goldsmithing and being able to do it in combination.
That's I mean, I don't know that I've seen that before, and I'm excited that that's what's going to be featured when you're in the magazine for the spring issue of What Women Create. So I'm super excited to see that. One other thing I did want to ask you about and have you talk about, and this is really initially how we sort of met through email, is your Rare Roses project. And that was more of a painting project, but I'd love for you to tell our audience about that as well.
Yeah, sure. So the interesting thing about the Rare Roses is it was a personal creative project. It was never intended to be something that I showed. I don't really think so. Like looking back, like it was art therapy. So, for me, I was processing a lot of frustration. Maybe there was like an end in mind, but it was never clarified. So my son was really, really sick a number of times throughout his early childhood, but particularly when I was making the Rare Rose series, I was in the hospital with him. I don't leave when he's in the hospital. My husband will have to be there for me to like go down the hallway, but I literally don't leave the building. So if Quinn's in the hospital for a month and a half, I'm in the hospital for a month and a half. And so I just sat by his bedside and I did these watercolors. They were originally pen and watercolor. And it was my way of kind of trying to put into words in a non-confrontational way that I feel it's wrong that just because someone's different, they're treated as less than. And the reason that I was dealing with this as an issue was because my son was born missing 263 genes. And as a result, he had a number of bodily malformations. He's developmentally delayed. And I experienced a lot of instances in his early childhood, especially where he was treated as less than. And I felt like human value should just be a given, right? You're human, therefore you are valuable. It's innate. And regardless of your genetic differences, regardless of your developmental delays, regardless of whatever. But it wasn't something that everyone I interacted with felt. And so what I decided to do is figure out what could be something we could all agree on that had innate value. And I thought about it a lot. There was like showering, thinking about it, going to bed, thinking about it, journaling, thinking about it. And I came up with the idea that like roses have been valued across cultures, across history. They are kind of a universally revered flower. And then of course I had to check, I was like, okay, well, let me do some research, make sure there's nobody that like really hates roses. Sure enough, they're really revered across the world. And so I thought, oh, well, that's really intriguing, right? Because roses are an organism, so they could have genetic abnormalities. So I went on LinkedIn. I love LinkedIn because you can reach experts that are passionate about their field and ask them specific questions about the things they geek out over, and they will give you more information than you know what to do with. And so I was given PDFs and research papers and all kinds of images of what roses look like when they have genetic abnormalities. And it was great. I had all the reference images I needed. And so I started painting. And yeah, I just painted as like a way to get my feelings out, not really knowing what I was going to do with it. And after I painted 12, I felt like, no, I'm good, right? 12, it's a dozen. I showed them to my husband. My husband is kind of the one that pushes me to like show things and do things. And he was like, you need to do something with these. You need to
Right.
scan them, put them online, do something. So I showed them to moms in the support groups that I was in, like people that had very similar stories, and they loved them. And then my husband was like, oh, you should, this is when the NFTs were like really a thing. He was like, oh, you should make NFTs out of the scans. And so I made NFTs of it, but I didn't know how to do it. So if you go on, you can find them listed, but like, I don't even think they're for sale. Like, they're there, but I don't know what to do with them after that. And then I felt really empowered. Like people were really responding to them, especially in the
Right.
support groups. And a lot of people said, like, are you going to show them? How big are they? I'm like, they're really small. They're only like 12 by 12. And so I reached out to the Greenwood Genetic Center, which is actually the center that tested my son, and determined his genetic abnormality. And yeah, I said, would you be interested if I printed them large and did a show in your space? And they said, oh no, not only would we love that, but we're having a conference and it would be amazing
Oh,
if you
wow.
could print them all, because I said there was 12, print them really big because we have a big space. And we'd also love for you to talk about your experience with your
Wow.
son. And I was like, wow, oh, I didn't expect that. But
Good.
I leaned into it,
I
and yeah, it was amazing. It was an amazing experience.
bet.
And I printed them on canvas, and they all sold because, of course, it was a conference of geneticists coming from all around the country. And so they were very, very, a very specialized audience that understood the message that I was exploring.
Right.
And yeah, they purchased them for their institutions. And so the rare roses wound up being like these very personal things that I made and turned into being something that now you can find at the Chicago University, the MUSC here in Charleston, the Medical University of South Carolina, Boston Children's actually commissioned me to do work for them for their new genetics wing.
Oh.
And Clemson, I mean, all over. It was just so wonderful to see, work that was so personal being
Right.
understood and kind of like embraced by others. So yeah,
Oh,
that's.
such a beautiful story. And I, again, that is really what sort of attracted me to calling you and for us having that conversation. And now what I find really interesting is when you're talking about your flow challenge, you were saying, you need to work on a project that's for you, something for you that only has you in mind. And essentially that is what you did with this Rare Roses project. It was, you didn't intend for it to become this huge success and so well received, and to have these pieces printed in these, wings of these enormous hospitals, and because you did it for you. And maybe if you had had that in mind, well, what are they going to want to see? Or what would they, what colors would they appreciate? Or what type of arrangement would they find nice? That you did it solely for you. And I think that authenticity probably comes through, and it's probably the reason why it's so popular.
I definitely think there's so much wisdom in that, what you just said, because I feel like many artists who are professional artists struggle with the market. They struggle with determining what's going to sell and what's going to be, the best approach to creating something that people will be interested in. And I have time and time again seen that when you make something from a place that is personal, and that carries a piece of your heart. It is vulnerable, it is hard, but that's when people can connect most clearly with it. And yeah, it's going to separate those that don't understand. They're not going to be able to identify with it. But our work
That's
is,
okay.
that's okay. Yeah, like I think it's very important that the work is something not only that you love, but also that speaks your truth. And that's when it does. It becomes richer. It absolutely does. So I was actually contacted by a woman who does documentary films about plants, and it was a very unexpected contact. She reached out over Instagram and said that she's doing a documentary about roses, and that she came across my paintings and would love for me to be in the documentary. And
Wow.
I was shocked. I was like, well, my paintings aren't exactly about roses. They're kind of about something else. She said, no, I love it. I'm very interested. She's absolutely wonderful woman. She came to the studio and met my family. And I think it's just such a great example of how having your work be personal really can allow you to connect with others in a way that it wouldn't be possible if your work was solely commercial. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think art with connection is complicated. It's difficult because you're often creating for a certain audience. And when you're not creating for an audience, and when you are just creating for yourself, I do think, and I've heard this from artists before, that's when they create their best work, their most meaningful work. And again, it was just for them. In this case, the rare roses, they were just for you to find a way to express what you were feeling using a medium that felt comfortable to you, right? And that happened to be painting. It's just such a beautiful story. And I really think that others can identify with that type of art and connection. And that I think that's why I just love it so much. I love that again, and it hasn't stopped there. You know, now there's a documentary. I think you should write a book. I think you should have these in a book and explaining the process. I would buy that book. I would buy several copies of that book. So, but again, it's taken on so many other iterations where it just started as these small little pieces of paper in the hospital. And look where it's gone. And not only that, I mean, obviously all of these other things that you do have been incorporated into your success, but there's something about that story that just gets me in the heart. So, I'm excited for you. I'm excited for the documentary. Do you know anything about when that will be out?
I don't know exactly when it'll be out. It will be out this year, but my story is only one of a number of stories she'll be exploring associated with roses. So I do know that last I spoke with her, she was in the UK. Actually, I didn't speak with her. She texted me. It was actually the other day. She surprised me. She's checked in with us a number of times. Like I said, she's absolutely lovely. She'll text us occasionally and just see how we're doing. She's really become a friend, but she sent me these pictures of flowers unexpectedly the other day. And I looked at them really closely. I'm like, oh my goodness. She actually found in a rose garden in the UK roses that have genetic abnormalities.
Oh my
And
goodness.
she said she's been going to rose gardens now for over a year as a part of the documentary. And she said that every time she goes, she looks for roses that have genetic variants. And she usually like asks whoever's there with her to be like, oh, help me find them. And she actually found four blooms. So I was so
Wow.
excited. And she said she was so excited. But it was just amazing because all the reference pictures I've had were sent by the botanist through LinkedIn. So I've never seen them in
In
person.
person. Wow, that is crazy. I love that. Okay, so moving on to our next topic here. A couple of other questions that I wanted to ask you. You have this history with everything from physicians to neuroscientists to psychologists to botanists to documentarians. What is some of the best advice you've ever received in your journey?
I think that if you follow your curiosity, you're going to uncover really fascinating things. It's not just about learning, it's also about allowing yourself to be open to new experiences, which actually is a flow trigger. Curiosity is a flow trigger, learning is a flow trigger, and openness to new experiences is actually one of the key components of a creative prone person, someone that has a high propensity for creativity. So, in my life and in my experience, I've always found that openness to learning and to new experiences has allowed me to navigate uncertainty, has allowed me to navigate difficulty, really being open to taking the next step, even when the path ahead isn't clear, and kind of leaning into even, when things are ambiguous. That's also a key component of a creative propensity is the willingness to hold ambiguity and to be okay navigating within that space. We don't always have all the answers. We know that, But when we are okay with that, when we're comfortable with that, and we allow ourselves to continue to explore and to continue to ask questions and to continue to journey forward with just really a curious lens, I feel like that's where the magic happens. I think that's the best way to say it.
No, I agree with that. In fact, one of my favorite quotes by Dorothy Parker is the cure for boredom is curiosity, and there's no cure for curiosity. And it just speaks to what you just said. It's very true. You have to have that. You have to have that in order to keep yourself knowledgeable and fresh, and especially for in the realm of creativity and for creatives, getting stuck is something we hear a lot about, writer's block and creative block. So the opposite of flow, obviously. But part of that, it doesn't surprise me that curiosity is one of the flow triggers. That makes perfect sense, that you have to be open to newness, right?
And I think too is understanding the many facets of curiosity is also really important, because oftentimes we don't recognize that curiosity can come in the form of a question. It can come in the form of a willingness to step back and look at something from a new perspective. And so that's something we can use in our lives when things seem absolutely impossible and there's no doors forward. Sometimes we have to stand back and completely flip the question upside down and re-examine things from a new perspective. And that's a big piece of curiosity. It's not just a willingness to learn new things, it's a willingness to consider that there's something that we haven't even thought we needed to learn, and questions that we haven't even been willing to really recognize are necessary to ask. Does that make sense?
It does. It's not just a matter of learning a path forward. Sometimes you actually have to create and establish that path forward. And I'm sure you saw that with your son. There really wasn't like a map for you to follow. Be curious about A, B, C, and D. You had to create A, B, C, and D. And so that
Absolutely.
makes perfect sense. Yes. Well, one of the things I'd like to do is kind of end on a win, just anything personally, professionally, creatively, that you've been doing lately that feels like a win to you.
So I would say that when an idea starts on paper and, you're sketching this new ambitious project, sometimes it doesn't come together when you start to actually do it in 3D, and for me in full form. I have really felt that embarking on this ceramics, figurative ceramics work is coming along in a way that I hadn't expected. And once again, I've recognized my life kind of coming full circle. The work that I'm exploring is coming out of all the reading that I've been doing over the last year or two on post-traumatic growth and the realization that we can not only heal after we've been through something difficult, but that we can grow from it and in many ways become more resilient and become more empowered because of what we've gone through. And so the work is a little ambitious for me to try to kind of encapsulate that, my own experience, but also in a way that's open for others to kind of maybe see their story in it. And I'm feeling like wherever this goes, if it feels like an exciting journey.
That's incredible. Well, I cannot wait to see it. And I know spring 2027 seems like a really long time away, but we worked so far in advance. If I could have put you in an earlier issue, I would have. But I just want to thank you so much, not just for being here today, but also for exploring these topics with us. A lot of it was deeply personal. I appreciate so much your willingness to share your story. I do think it is through those authentic, real stories that we find the biggest connection with others. And so I just want to thank you. I know that might not always be an easy thing to do, and I really appreciate you taking the time with us today to share.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks again. All of Nicole's information will be down in the notes, including how to experience and take advantage of her Creative Flow Challenge, which honestly is something I would love to do as well.
I did have one other thing I wanted to mention. If people were just curious to learn a little bit more about flow, they can go to creativeflowfinder.com. And I actually have an online quiz that helps them figure out their flow state propensity and really identify a pathway for them personally to get into flow state.
Oh, I love that. I'll be taking that quiz. Thank you, Nicole. I really appreciate your time.
Definitely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today for the World of Women Create podcast. As we close the studio door on today's episode, we hope you're walking away with a little more color and a lot more inspiration. The World of Women Create is ever evolving, and we are so grateful you're on this path with us. To stay connected between episodes, visit us at womencreate.com. Until next time.